Marvels of creation and science. Job 12 verse 7 to 13 says, "But now, ask the beasts, and they will teach you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. And the fish of the sea will explain it to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hands is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days understanding. With him are wisdom and strength, he has counsel and understanding." So in the book of Job, we hear that there's lots that the animals can teach us. There's much in modern technology that is marvelous. However, the incredible complexity and intricacy of God's creation is infinitely more marvelous than man's greatest scientific inventions. Many of today's scientific achievements are inspired by and modeled on marvels of nature. For centuries, men dreamed of flying. And they even patented things like this that obviously couldn't possibly work. However, men do not have muscles powerful enough to lift their own body weights into air. So the best that we could actually do over the years was to glide downhill, to find a high point and jump off and hope that you can glide for a while. And it wouldn't be for very long that you could glide by unpowered flight. But in 1781, James Watt invented a steam engine that produced rotary power. And this was phenomenal, because up till the year 1800, nobody could travel faster than a horse could run. That was the top speed you could reach. And only after the invention of the steam engine could in the 1800s people start to go faster than a horse. In 1876, Nicholas Otto built an internal combustion engine, followed by Rudolf Diesel with a diesel engine. And this now made all kinds of travel possible. The brothers Wilbur and Orville Wright had wanted to fly since they'd played with kites as boys. Later they learned engineering skills by building bicycles, and this is actually their bicycle shop. The Wright brothers built bicycles before making aeroplanes. They realized that the key challenge of flight was to design a craft that could be controlled. A plane that could not be balanced in the air is as useless as a bicycle which cannot be steered. And there have been some very interesting flight ideas which didn't work, and a lot of crashes recorded along the way. Perhaps you've watched those magnificent men in their flying machines. Wilbur watched birds in flight, and he noticed how they bank into a turn much like a cyclist does, how you lean into the curve. He concluded that birds turn and keep balance by twisting their wingtips. He resolved to design a wing that could twist. So in 1900, Wilbur and Orville built an aircraft with twistable wings. They flew it first as a kite and later as a piloted glider. And they patented this. They discovered an aircraft needs three basic controls to adjust pitch, roll, and side-to-side movement. However, they were frustrated that the wings did not produce enough lift. The Wright brothers built a wind tunnel. They experimented with hundreds of wing shapes until they found the ideal shape, size, and angle. In 1902, with the new design, they mastered the art of balancing the aircraft on the wind. Now what they need to do is mount an engine on it. So with the knowledge they'd gained from the wind tunnel, they designed a propeller. They then had to build an engine. And finally, on the 17th of December, 1903, the Wright brothers started the engine, the propeller spun, and the aircraft lifted into the cold wind. This introduced the age of flight. And just an incredible thing to think that in barely 50 years, we were into jets, and then 60 years into flying to the moon and all that. As the brothers became international celebrities, they pointed out that God's creation taught them all the principles of flight. The Word of God tells us, "But now ask the birds of the air, and they will tell you, the hand of the Lord has done this." It is apparent that everything about a bird is designed for flight. The shafts of the wing feathers support a bird's entire weight during flight. How can they be so light and yet so strong? And we've picked up feathers, and I mean, they weigh feathers. And they're really, really light. But if you cut through the shaft of a feather, you'll see an engineering masterpiece. The shafts of feathers have a foam sandwich of cross beams that strengthen the light design. Engineers have studied the shafts of bird feathers and used the foam sandwich seam design in aircraft. Engineers have studied these shafts and have used them in everything from the Blackbird, which is the most supersonic jet spy fighter possible, through to when they were building the space shuttle. The bones of birds are hollow. In many cases, they're strengthened by internal struts in the form of what engineers call the Warren girder. Now, the hollow bones of birds are honeycombed with air spaces and strengthened by crisscrossing struts. And the number of hollow bones varies from species to species, but the large gliding birds and the large soaring birds tend to have the most air space. Their bones are the most hollow because they need it. And it's an amazing design that they have. When engineers designed the wings of the space shuttle, they incorporated these features, which have been observed in the bones of birds, the Warren girder in particular. Pilots balance modern aircraft by adjusting flaps on the wing and the tail. The average bird uses some 48 muscles in its wings and shoulders to change the configuration and motion of its wings and individual feathers. Birds can make multiple adjustments several times a second. And if you've watched birds in flight, you can see just how amazingly agile and versatile they are. They're like gymnasts in the air. And the extraordinary ability how they can twist and turn and change. Eagles and falcons are the examples and envy of aircraft designers. They study the eagles and the falcons to know how to design the aircraft. And when you think of excellence, just think of how well the eagles can see. If you think of human eye, it's quite amazing. An eagle can see 18 to 20 times as well as we can. And the eagle's eyes are so good that there have been pilots up at 18,000 feet seeing an eagle flying near them suddenly go hurtling down to the ground and they catch a rodent or something. They could spot it from so far up in the sky, kilometers up in the sky. And they could spot a rodent on the ground and come plummeting down at something in the region of 280 kilometers an hour. But when they hit the prey, it's at 120 kilometers an hour, and they hit them with their talons. And these talons are so powerful. I mean, just watch here the fish eagle at work. When it comes to learning how to fish, they are just engineered, precision engineered for excellence. And when you look at their talons are bigger and longer than lion's claws. They can put 480 pounds of pressure per square inch, but it's not per square inch. It's actually on a point as sharp as the edge of a sharpened pencil. They can crack skulls. I mean, it's an instant kill when an eagle or falcon hits its prey at about 120 k's an hour. And engineered precision. Now, this is design. In fact, you even hear people talking about how they're engineered and designed, but you can be expelled from universities and lose your job as a professor if you believe in intelligent design. You're meant to believe all this happened by accident. Flight, especially takeoff, consumes a lot of energy. So birds need a powerful, fast-burning engine. A bird's heart beats faster than that of a similar-sized mammal, and it's usually larger and more powerful than the heart of a similar-sized mammal. So, well, we have here someone trained in midwifery. So, Talita, how many times a minute does a human heart beat, roughly?
60 to 100.
Right, 60 to 100. Now, a hummingbird's heart beats 1,260 times a minute. That's just incredible. But, of course, they're very small, and they've got a lot to do with that very small body, and they need a heart that can beat so much faster. 1,260 times a minute. Also, the bird's lungs have a different one-way flow design that's more efficient than mammals. They've got inflow and outflow with their oxygen, with their lungs. Absolutely amazing. We don't have that. One measure of an aircraft's efficiency is whether it can take off carrying sufficient fuel. Now, when a Boeing 747 jumbo jet takes off for a 10-hour flight, like from Johannesburg to Frankfurt, for example, roughly a third of its weight is fuel. Similarly, a migrating thrush may lose half its body weight on a 10-hour flight. The barn swallow is one of the wonders of God's creation, very small. At 18 grams, it's one of the smallest migrating birds. The average barn swallow flies 12,000 kilometers every year. And they're such small little birds. It leaves Europe during August, September, when they're going into the autumn, and it comes down and it enjoys summer in the southern hemisphere, and then flies back. They breed in Europe, but they summer in South Africa. And the barn swallows fly up to 50 kilometers a day, even when they're at home, to forage. They serve God and people by controlling the aerial insect population, especially mosquitoes. I've come across these. I've seen millions of them, literally 3 million, arrive near Givinodi Mission in Kaimans, Tongaat in Natal. And these come straight from Germany, and when they move in, it's wonderful because you're not going to worry about mosquitoes for a long time. And they just move in there, and it's phenomenal. To travel from Natal to Germany takes a month. They fly an average of 400 kilometers a day when they're migrating. About 3 million barn swallows migrate between Germany and South Africa every year. These are little 18-gram birds. And when you look at the Atlas of Bird Migration and the different paths that these birds take, one of the paths that many birds take is coming across where the state of Israel is and across Egypt, down across Sudan and into the different countries in Africa where they have their secondary citizenship. There are four main routes into Africa. There are those crossing from Yemen and into Eritrea, across that narrow strait at the end of the Red Sea. You've got, of course, the land bridge between Israel and Egypt. Then those who come down the boot of Italy and Sicily into Tunisia and down, and those who cross from Spain into Casablanca, Morocco, and into West Africa. So these are the four main routes of bird migrations. And there's a lot of birds. Swallows and eagles and storks and cranes and falcons and pelicans flying backwards and forwards between the autumns of Europe into our summers and back again. They don't like winter, evidently. And there's a lot of these birds who are flying backwards and forwards. In fact, it's a whole massive study, the different birds and the distances they cover. It's phenomenal, every single year. And we can come across some of them, like the flamingos, up near Langebahn. And you look in the flay there, an amazing amount may come from Russia. And so you get this something like 18,000 Russian flamingos moving in there every single year. And this is all over the world. There's a phenomenal amount of bird migrations backwards and forwards. And we have a lot of them ending up in South Africa. South Africa is a very popular destination. And it's not just birds. There are also sea creatures. There's the southern right whales. There are the ones who are going backwards and forwards between the Mozambique Channel and around the Cape. And there's massive amounts of migrations of land animals, of sea creatures, of dolphins and turtles, and amazing. And, of course, the bird life. The prize for endurance has got to go to the Bartell Godwit. They take off from Alaska, heading for New Zealand. Half its body weight is fat. This astonishing bird flies for over 190 hours, 8 days non-stop. There's nowhere to stop en route. 8 days non-stop flying. No commercial aircraft could fly for 190 hours non-stop. This is just humanly impossible, even with a machine. But God has trained and engineered the bar-tailed godwit that they can do it. So you could study the whole world as a world of birds, amongst other creatures. Now, perhaps you've had a problem finding a way across an unfamiliar town. I've had to navigate my way across Frankfurt and Berlin and Paris and London and New York and Washington and many other strange towns far away. And even with maps and directions, you can get lost. So how do navigators find their ways across featureless oceans? Merely having a compass does not help unless the navigator knows what his position is in relation to his destination. We've discussed this issue before. But not until the invention of the sextant and the marine chronometer in the 1730s could navigators determine the exact location and plot their course on a map. But each fix would require complex calculations. However, today, motorists and sailors in many countries navigate using a global positioning system, a GPS. I didn't know anything about GPS when I was growing up, but they were actually designed in the 1960s for military use. I know the man who pioneered this, General Ben Parton, and he designed GPSs to deliver cruise missiles, that they could go to the exact address and explode right at the doorstep of wherever they were targeted to go. So GPS were designed to deliver precision-guided weapons, especially what we call cruise missiles. The GPS was later made available to the public, becoming operational for the public by the 1990s. And interesting that a whole lot of, and we've got one of our first GPSs in the display cabinet there that made a mission into Stan 1997, ended up underwater in the Yeh River, which is why the GPS sitting there. Couldn't handle that. That was the last mission that GPS could use. But nevertheless, some of our missionaries know how to use GPSs. I'm still a map person and only comfortable when I've got real maps. And so others on the team might be using a GPS. I'll be sitting there with a hard copy maps and take a compass with me when I travel, because that's what I'm used to and I was brought up with. But the GPS is a marvel of computer technology. The device can show you exact location on your screen and guide you to the address where you want to go. Now, how does it do that? Satellite navigation devices depend on 30 satellites that each broadcast signals, indicating the satellite position and the time to the accuracy of a few billionth of a second, if one can imagine how on earth that's even possible. But once your GPS establishes contact with three satellites, it can triangulate and accurately measure how long the signal takes to travel from the satellite to your receiver. And this requires pretty complex calculations. Consider this. In a few seconds, your GPS must compute the distance to three satellites, all thousands of kilometers away, traveling in different directions at speeds of many kilometers per second. Yet the GPS is clearly not the first automatic navigation device. Jeremiah 8 verse 7. Even the stork in the heaven knows her appointed times, and the turtle dove, and the swift, and the swallow observe the times of their coming. But my people do not know the judgment of the Lord. And here Jeremiah points out that birds and animals can be more intelligent and understand the times and have better contact with their Creator than many people, even people who are meant to be God's people. Sometimes people can be incredibly insensible to spiritual realities. The storks. We've got storks who live in Germany and Russia, and they travel backwards and forwards to South Africa. Amazing. And you can go to Switzerland and Austria and Germany, and you see homes where people actually even place a stork nest on top, or where they can build a platform where they could build their nest. And these storks come from, their breeding grounds are all the green, dark green areas. And you can see they travel from Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, to Ukraine and Germany, and all the way from Denmark to Spain across. And many of them come all the way down to South Africa. I remember seeing storks arriving in Rhodesia and in Natal, and then they would disappear for our winter as they went back up to Europe. Jeremiah writes about the migrating of storks and swallows over 2,500 years ago, before the encyclopedias on bird migrations and so on were published, obviously. Today, people are still marveling at creatures that migrate. How do they do it? Consider the salmon that can swim thousands of kilometers in the ocean and return to the stream where they were born. How do they navigate? Even a dead fish can float downstream, but the steel-headed trout swims upstream. I've seen them in New York State, in Pennsylvania, going up waterfalls, literally jumping up waterfalls, falling back most of the time, but they persist and persist until they get up there. The steel-headed trout goes against the flow. What a great example of going against peer pressure. They don't go with the flow, they go against the flow, they swim upstream, they jump up waterfalls to ensure that their offspring are born in the highlands like they were. And then there's the leatherback sea turtles who've made incredible journeys, one that nested in Indonesia was tracked as it migrated 20,000 kilometers to the coast of Oregon in the United States. And these leatherback turtles often returned to the same area of Indonesia to nest again. And they've put GPS trackers on them like they have on some of our penguins. Percy, Peter, and Pamela penguin, for example, back in the year 2000. And were astounded at how fast and how far they could travel and find their way back to their actual nesting grounds. Then there's the monarch butterflies from vast areas of North America who migrate more than 1,700 kilometers to a small area of Mexico. And even though they've never been to Mexico before, they find their way often to the same trees where their great-grandparents roosted the previous year. I mean, butterflies don't live that long. And it's just amazing how even they can migrate. Just how they do it still baffles the researchers. We don't know how they do it. And so a whole lot of scientists say it's instinct. Define and explain instinct. They don't know. But just because we don't know how they do it doesn't mean that they don't know how they do it. Or maybe God just directs or guides them. Or he has built into them such a phenomenal GPS system. And it's not just birds or fish and land animals that migrate. Consider as humble a creature as a pigeon, which our cats devour frequently. Homing pigeons have been transported more than 150 kilometers to unfamiliar places. And just to show you how, now we know homing pigeons can find their way home. In fact, they used them during the war. Millions of homing pigeons were used during the First World War, and hundreds of thousands were even used in the Second World War to get messages back. And they had something like a 96% success rate, even though they were often targeted by enemy trying to shoot at homing pigeons of the other side. But they got through 96% of the time, giving messages that were either put around their necks or attached to their feet. And so to test homing pigeons, they put some under deep anesthesia. And in rotating drums, can you imagine? Yet after circling a few times, they've calculated the position, turned accurately towards home and found it. How on earth do they do it? Researchers have gone so far as to force these pigeons to wear frosted eyeglasses, for goodness sakes. I mean, talk about making it really hard to... And they still find their way home. So they now believe that pigeons calculate their position in relation to home by detecting the directions by which they receive important navigational information. Scientists took 18 albatross by plane from a small island in the center of the Pacific Ocean. And the Pacific Ocean is the biggest ocean in the world. It's so big, you could take the whole landmass of Asia and drop it in the Pacific Ocean and there'd be space left over. And there's even places so deep in the Pacific, it could accommodate the whole Himalayas mountains right up to Mount Everest. There's places so deep in the Pacific that it exceeds the height of the mountains in the Himalayas. So if you can just imagine, middle of the Pacific Ocean, biggest ocean in the world, they take these albatross away. Why they did this, I don't know. These poor albatross. But anyway, they took them thousands of kilometers away and released them. Some would take the western rim of the Pacific Ocean, some to the eastern rim. But within a few weeks, most of these albatross had returned to a small island in the center of the Pacific. How do they do it? Whereas our automatic navigation systems may depend totally on satellites, many animals seem to be able to use various navigational methods, from observing landmarks and the sun, to detecting magnetic fields, distinctive smells, and even sounds. But they find their way across thousands of kilometers. Biology professor James Gold wrote, "Animals whose lives depend on accurate navigation are uniformly over-engineered." Note that word, over-engineered. They usually come equipped with alternative strategies, a whole series of backups between which they switch depending on which is provided and what's the most reliable information. So, you know, the sun's not much good if you're in the middle of a storm or if you've got massive cloud cover and things like this. And you can't exactly guide by the stars if you can't see it because it's overcast. And so there's a whole lot of different mechanisms that they've got backups. Over-engineered, says this scientist. The sophistication of animal navigation continues to intrigue and confound scientific investigators. And to think that there's people out there who are hostile to intelligent design. Well, how can you not believe in intelligent design? The evidence is everywhere. Just consider whales. In fact, there's some people who describe the world as the blue planet, but if you're in outer space and you look to Earth, well, 70% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. So this is actually the blue planet, because it's the only planet with water. And so they said to people from outer space, assuming you've got people in outer space, other people, planets far, far away or whatever, and they were to communicate to them, probably the first sounds they would hear would be the songs of the whales. When astronauts went out of space and they were trying to tune in the right frequency, they'd hear the whales singing. The songs of the whales under the ocean can be heard in outer space. And the whales can communicate to one another over thousands of kilometers underground with sophisticated, complex languages. And why do they jump out the water? Because they can. I mean, it's for fun. They're enjoying themselves. Then you take the dolphins. Now, if you talk fast, you might talk up to 140, 150 words a minute. That's pretty fast. Average person might be 80 words a minute, say. A dolphin can communicate 500 words a minute. Complex language. In fact, the Navy studies the dolphins. They study the dolphins. In fact, so much of naval technology is based upon the ability of the dolphins to track things. So if you put your hand into a water tank or in the ocean, side of the boat or something, they can tell the size of the hand, the composition of the hand, how much flesh there is, how many bones there are, which finger's got the metal ring on it. All of this, by they send out clicks every now and then, and the echoes that come back determine the makeup of what is in the ocean. They're extraordinarily intelligent. Maybe some people have seen a video that people were sending around recently of a huge pod of dolphins off Cape Point who had surrounded a group of sardines, and they were just taking turns circling the wagons and then diving in and fishing. And these dolphins surf. Dolphins actually enjoy surfing. They are intelligent creatures. I think the name of the Zulu for the dolphin is man's friend, or the friend of people, is it? The term in Zulu, I heard it explained to me by Fana Sabisi, that dolphins are known as the friend of people because they've saved so many people from drowning. So many people have had experiences of struggling, drowning, and a dolphin comes and rescues and helps them. Why did they do that? I mean, there's something absolutely extraordinary about dolphins. And they're extremely intelligent creatures, and they've got a very sophisticated communication system. And they can be heard not as far as the whales. I mean, the whales have bigger lungs and all that. But whales can communicate thousands of kilometers. Dolphins can communicate quite a long way, too. Now, in 1973, Dr. Martin Cooper was the first to demonstrate a handheld cellular phone. It had a battery, a radio, and a microprocessor or mini computer. And so New Yorkers were stunned to see Cooper make a phone call on the street. Well, you wouldn't be surprised anymore, but in 1973, that was quite amazing. Now, this invention was only made possible because of previous inventions. The invention of a reliable battery by 1800. And the development of the telephone by 1876. And the radio by 1895. And the computer by 1946, for sure. The invention of microprocessor by 1971 made cell phones finally possible because it could be a small computer. You didn't need a computer taking up room. Back in 1977, when I matriculated from Pilots High, my first job was running the ICL-2980 computer at Old Mutual, which was three stories high. It was bigger than this building here. And it went over three stories. And it was a whole lot of us having to operate this computer. It had something like 120 metallic tape decks upstairs where you had the different metallic tape deck things spinning. It had card machines with the holes in it. And it couldn't do as much as your laptop could today, but it was the biggest computer in the Southern Hemisphere at that time. It was an Old Mutual. So computers used to be quite big. Making computers small made cellular phones possible. However, communication with sophisticated devices was not actually that new. Since the dawn of creation, a communication device which has often been taken for granted is the voice. Not just the human voice, consider the dolphin's voice in the whale's voice too. But over half of the billions of neurons in the motor cortex of your brain are involved in controlling your speech organs. About 100 muscles operate the complex muscles of your jaw, your throat, your lips, your tongue, and your chest to enable you to speak. Muscles operate the complex mechanism, which there's so many muscles you can't see, but which are involved in just the process of speaking. Of course, the human voice could be of no benefit without the ear, and the ear is also part of the same communication system. You've got to be able to speak, and you've got to be able to hear at the same time. The ear converts sound into electric impulses that the brain can process. Your brain analyzes sound so that you can recognize people by the timbre of their voice. That's where you can have somebody behind you and you can recognize as they speak who it is, or from the telephone, you know the sound of the person's voice. Your brain also measures how many millionths of a second one ear hears before the other, and thus calculates by triangulating precisely in which direction and roughly from which distance the voice came from. Well, we don't think about that, but our brain is doing it. These are just two of the features that enable you to listen to one person at a time, even though several others may be talking in the background. So sophisticated wireless communication with caller recognition is not that new. It was first found in how God created us. Not just us, it's how he created all of his creatures. And we see how the dolphins and the whales have very complex recognition systems and communication abilities. And we don't know how many of the other animals have got such communication systems, but we hear the birds sing in the morning. We hear animals making different sounds, and even a lion's roar. What is that communicating? Soon after men learned to broadcast sound, inventors wondered if they could also transmit live pictures. So to appreciate the challenge, consider how television works. First, a TV camera focuses a scene onto a target device that records a picture. Instead of reading lines of letters on a page, you read, like you do in books, the television scans lines of spots or pixels in the picture. We've even got a whole film production company called Pixel. It converts these pixels into an electronic video signal. Video is a Latin word for I see, like audio is a Latin word for I hear. And these are transmitted to another place. So a receiver then converts this electronic signal back to a live picture. Now, John Logie Baird from Scotland has been credited as the inventor of the television. When poor health forced him to give up his job as an electrical engineer, he devoted his life to a subject which had fascinated him since he was a teenager: how to build a machine that could transport live images. So Baird's television camera used a hat box perforated by 30 holes as a disc. And as the disc spun, the hole scanned successful lines of the picture, and they allowed the light to fall onto a photoelectric cell. The cell produced a video signal that was received and transmitted to a receiver. And in the receiver, the signal was amplified to illuminate a variable light, and behind a similar spinning disc to reproduce the picture. The challenge was to synchronize the discs. So to support himself while working on this project, Baird raised funds by polishing shoes. It was long before people thought they needed government grants and things like that before they could do anything. On the 2nd of October, 1925, Baird transmitted the first television picture from one end of his attic to the other. And the first person ever to appear on television was a frightened office boy from downstairs who was paid half a crown for his services. In 1928, Baird broadcast the first television picture across the Atlantic. And the first time television was used practically was in Berlin, 1936, for the 1936 Olympics. And this is the size of these TV cameras. And this was Telefunken. They had commercialized, they had made televising the Olympic Games, which some only had a black and white receiver, others were able to get in color. But these are some of the images from the Berlin Olympics, 1936, which was the first televised Olympics ever, 1936. One of the most incredible Olympic Games ever, and one of the most amazing sights. However, this is not the first time that live pictures were ever transmitted. Proverbs 20 verse 12, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. Your eyes are like tiny television cameras. They convert images into electronic signals They transmit these signals along the optic nerve to the back of your brain, where the actual seeing takes place. The eye is a magnificent marvel in miniature, just 24 millimeters in diameter, 7.5 grams in weight. The eye is ingeniously engineered. For example, it has separate systems for dim and bright lighting. 30 minutes after entering a dark room, your eyes may become 10,000 times more sensitive to light. Your eye has over 100 times more light-sensitive pixels than most video cameras. Now, anyone who's been on a Great Commission course will discover this, how we get you into the forest in the dark and without torches. And after being in there for about 20 minutes, it's incredible how well you can see. And at first event, it's nothing. I mean, you can't see your hand in front of your face. And next thing, you can see the tree, the branches, the leaves. You can see the patterns of leaves. You can see the spider web. And suddenly it's pitch dark. What's changed? Nothing's changed except that your eye's adjusting and it's moving onto its other system. You've got night sights. Well, every cat's got night sights. They know that. Most of us don't know it because we always have lights around us. We're never in a dark situation where we can test our night sight ability. A large portion of those cells are packed into a small spot at the center of the retina called the fovea, which provides the sharpest vision. Electric signals from the light-sensitive cells pass from one nerve cell to another towards the optic nerve. But the nerve cells do far more than pass the signals on. They process the images, they enhance vital information, they suppress unneeded details so that you can sit in a room and you can focus. You can focus, 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 and everything else can sort of recede into almost nothingness because you're completely focused. Imagine a fighter pilot traveling at Mach 2 in a jet. He can glance down this control panel, he can glance out, and he can see hundreds of kilometers away. And he can look in, and just extraordinary. You can't focus a camera that fast as what the human eye can do. The visual cortex of your brain is a live, sophisticated video receiver. It sharpens images by enhancing edges, comparing signals from cells sensitive to primary colors, so you can distinguish literally millions of shades of color. That must be women. Most men have trouble defining between 6 or 8 colors, but women can go, you know, sort of, no, that's not white, that's eggshell. It's like, I don't know how they can see the difference, but obviously women have a far more precise ability to tell the shade, that that's the wrong shade for whatever it is, the drapes or so on, but you know, for a lot of us who are like, it looked the same to me. Your brain also compares the tiny dissimilarities between what your two eyes see so that you can perceive distance and depth. So it's absolutely amazing. So consider how your eyes can recognize faces in a distant crowd and send electrical impulse to your brain and then transform the signals into clear images. And consider how subtle details of these faces are compared with those in your memory so that you instantly recognize your friend that you may not have seen for months or even years. Isn't that process awe-inspiring? This is far more amazing than any cameras or artificial intelligence they're out there with. No wonder Psalm 104, verse 24 says, O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you've made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. Now, frequently you read in secular humanist scientific journals which claim to believe in evolution statements like this. Of all the body coverings nature's designed, feathers are the most various and the most mysterious. Designed. Did an evolutionist just say designed? I thought everything's just random accident. But it's true, feathers have been designed, have they not? And according to Oxford Dictionary, to design means to plan something with a specific purpose or intention in mind. That's why you have to believe in intelligent design, unless you're not intelligent. We can see design everywhere in nature. We can see it in plants. We can see it in trees. We can see it in fish. We can see it everywhere. How can you not believe in intelligent design? If you believe in design, you have to believe in a designer. Secular humanists who believe in evolution frequently refer to nature designing things, like cheetahs are engineered for speed. No jokes, they really are engineered for speed. But who engineered them? Although evolutionists may claim that they believe nature is a mere force, they attribute intelligent design to it, but then they'll fire people who say they believe in intelligent design. Can an impersonal force design things? What many evolutionists refer to as nature, we know to be creation. And the Creator does have a name. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. From nature, we learn that God's wisdom is superior to ours. If God can design things better than inventors can, does it not stand to reason that he can advise us better than human counselors can? As Francis Bacon, the father of the scientific method, once put it, there are two books laid before us to study to prevent us falling into error. First is the volume of the scriptures, which reveal the will of God. Then there's the volume of the creatures, which express his power. You know, when you look at a lion or a whale or an eagle, are you not inspired? It expresses something of the power of the Creator. The great astronomer, Johannes Kepler, from the 16th into 17th century, is the founder of celestial mechanics. He was described as a brilliant mathematician, astronomer, who contributed to the scientific revolution with his works on the planetary orbits, the laws of motion, and the scientific method. Kepler's accomplishments formed the foundation of modern theoretical astronomy. Kepler viewed all science as man attempting to think God's thoughts after him. We study God's world to discover more about the Creator. Science, geography, biology, all these studies should help us to understand more of the nature of God. Sir Isaac Newton, the father of calculus and dynamics, was a scientific genius and a dedicated Christian. Newton formulated the theory of gravitation and the laws of motion. He made vital contributions to mathematics, astronomy, and physics. Newton maintained that there are two sources of knowledge. One is revealed in the Bible, and the other is revealed in nature. Newton believed that in order to truly know the Creator, you must study the natural order of things. Newton dedicated his life to know the Word of God, the Bible, and the works of God in creation. And while he's known primarily as a scientist, he actually wrote more on theology than he even did on science. Samuel F.B. Morse, who in the 19th century is the man responsible for the development of the telegraph and the Morse code, named after him, which was one of the greatest innovations in the world of communication, because before that time you couldn't communicate beyond the line of sight with flags and sarampos and visual beacons and so on. To communicate out of the line of sight was impossible before the invention of the Morse code and telegraph. Samuel deeply absorbed his family's Calvinism, which he eventually applied to all his scientific work. In 1844, Samuel Morse astonished the United States Congress, gathered in the Supreme Court chamber, by sending out the words for Numbers 23, verse 23. What hath God wrought? The first four words communicated by telegraph. The first intercity telegraph line in the world communicated these words of scripture to inaugurate the great invention. Morse laid the foundations for the development of modern communications. Now, the designer of our organs for communication, ears, eyes, mouth, tongue, so on, he obviously wants to communicate with us. He's enabled us to communicate and to hear communication. If we find learning about inventors fascinating and interesting, we should find learning about the Creator far more fascinating. Whether they acknowledge it or not, scientists have learned design from our Creator God. Even when you look at something like camouflage for military uniforms, they looked at tigers and they started with tiger stripes in uniforms, because that's how tigers are. And then they looked at leopard spots. And it was taking from nature camouflage that camouflage started to become integrated into military uniforms. Now you see these people walking around in cities wearing camouflage uniforms. It's obviously a bit pointless, because that doesn't work outside the bush, but anyway, I think they kind of have missed the point lately. just like you have some animals like chameleons on who can merge with whatever is the background where they are, it would be useful to have camouflage that suits the city too, but some of these characters have missed the point. God speaks to us through general revelation in creation and through special revelation in the Bible. And when we study his works in the light of his word, we come to understand the God of creation. Hebrews 1 says, God, who at various times, in various ways, spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son. And one of the commentaries in the book of Hebrews has this title, What More Could God Say? God has spoken through the prophets, he has spoken in and through his Son. What more can he say? All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Now, if one wants to learn more about creation, we've got one of the finest creation scientists in our country, Dr. Philip Stott. We'll be able to have him here for different seminars over the recent years, even earlier this year, and we've got box sets of DVDs of his presentations, Biblical Worldview Summit box sets, and on our website. And, of course, this is also part of our series of How to Answer Skeptics. There's many great resources that we can use to reclaim our communities for Christ. Any questions, any comments on nature, science, design? Yes. Yes, interesting you bring that up, because all these flags have a meaning. Some have letters, some have meanings in and of themselves. And when you drive into the waterfront, Cape Town waterfront, you see a whole lot of flags at the front. They've put up naval flags thinking this is clever, but some of the flags that go up there say bubonic plague and typhus and so on, which is what you're meant to put to warn people that you've got bubonic plague or typhus on board and so that stay away from ship. So interesting, it's driving the waterfront, and if someone understands Serampore flags, it's like, don't come here, they've got typhus and they've got bubonic plague. And there's a whole lot of, you know, distress. There's also the distress flags up there. So they've got a whole lot which, obviously the people who own the waterfront have no idea what they're putting up there. But all these flags have meanings. And now in connection with them also, the military had ideas that you could have flags where, okay, they don't have to, the colors don't have to be important. The ships used specific colors. But in the army, they'd often have it where they would be holding up the flags in different ways, which would be, you know, each one would be meaning a different thing. So they'd work out different letters so they could communicate. Morse code is by sound. And then you've got also light. So if you've got a torch, you can be flashing, you know, one short, three long, two short, one long, and so on and so forth, and they can spell it out, and that's how, you know, you've got your SOS was one of the first ones which save ourselves, which was first used for the Titanic, actually. They were the first to actually utilize this new convention that if you're in distress, you can use the SOS Morse code signal, and which stood for save ourselves, but it was just because it's a very short, easy code for one to transmit and to immediately get attention. And so there's lights, and you might have seen also ships often using where they've got these flaps on, and so they could have short, long, and you know, the amount of short and the amount of long, and that will communicate different letters of the alphabet. And then they had codes and they had abbreviations, but the flags can communicate a lot. So if you've got a naval man, like I remember Bill Bathman communicating to Christopher about what the different flags meant. And Chris, maybe you remember when Grandad was going through some of the codes, and you're saying, can you say that in English? And he just collapsed in laughter, because, of course, it is communicating to a naval man when he's learnt the codes. Now, I still learnt army codes, so, you know, the Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. Now, why do you put it like that? Because if you're speaking of a static radio, and did he say a B or did he say a P? And so things like this, there's a lot of things that M and N, which was, so that's why they pronounce out Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, you know, be specific. And so we each have our code. So, for example, I'm PH, so my code when we were doing Shortwave would be Papa Hotel, you know, PH. And Frontline Fellowship would be Foxtrot, Foxtrot. And so you've got all the alphabetical communication systems. There's a lot of communications, but now if you want to go to code, then you've got to have things not meaning what they apparently are saying, so that another person won't know unless he knows the code. But yeah, the flags, they would have used those from the castle as well. And there were times before I've seen pictures of the castle where they had these metal signs where they could pull up this flap and that flap and so on to make up different codes, so they didn't have to stand there holding the flags, but a person from a distance, like at Signal Hill, for example, or up at the blockhouse, could see the signal from the castle just in terms of the flags, and then it was a metal grid that had the different flags they could put up that people could see at a time. And then you know that for a special code to mobilize people, enemy invading, it could be lighting beacons. You think Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, the beacons being lit. And that was how they alerted Queen Elizabeth and the English army to the Spanish armadas coming. When they first saw them coming near the Isle of Wight, lit the first beacon, and next beacon, next hill could see, and then they went all the way through till all of England knew about it and could be mobilized. And the castle at the Cape had something like that, where they had beacons that could be lit on the different mountaintops all the way through, so that they castle could communicate the blockhouse could communicate through to the Helsworchter, and Helsworchter through, and very quickly, all the way up to the Boerland, they could hear whatever needed to be communicated. And you'd start sometimes maybe with a fire at night, but during daytime, they would be using flags. And sometimes to get the attention of the ones there, if it's really urgent, they might fire a cannon. So that you're looking to, what did they fire the cannon, and they would use the different flags to indicate the message that need to be relayed. Communications come a long way. When we started our work, telegram was very popular. A telegram came for the post office and it physically delivered to you, and it would be typed out on a long strip, and they'd tape it down a piece of paper, put an envelope, come deliver it to you. And so my call to missions came by telegram, not the app that some people have today, which was on a piece of paper delivered by the post. They delivered quickly, so it could get you within a few hours of being sent. And I was called to Hospital Christian Fellowship in a report, 25 Oak Avenue, Kempton Park, soonest. That was my call. Well, it actually started with have haircut, report 25 Oak Avenue, Kempton Park, soonest. That was Francis Grimm's call to me after 2 months of stewing over my application, and then finally got that call. We used telegrams a lot. And then we were using faxes a lot. Then we did shortwave radio a lot. And the idea that email, so you can see some of the old technology in the display cabinets there. But there was a time when the fax machine was the latest and greatest technology out there. And you know why they had to invent the fax machine? The fax machine was important because they had telegraph and they could transmit alphabetically according to the English language. But the American Navy had a problem. How could they transmit Japanese military signals? Because Japanese doesn't compute to Western alphabet, does it? And so they invented the fax machine in the 1920s, specifically for naval intelligence to be able to send through Japanese or Chinese, for that matter, or Arabic, script that could then be read as it is. So a fax machine or facsimile is the same as having a picture taken. And then they could decipher from there, crack the code, and so on. So fax machines were around since the 1920s militarily, but we only got to start using them in the late 1980s, early 1990s. I think Frontline got our first fax machine 86, 87 maybe, something like that. We got our first fax machine. Up till then, we had telexes. A telex that would come in long strip holes. You'd have to run through another machine to be able to turn those holes into the letters and decipher what was said. But we used to have on our letterheads our telex address as well. And you think now that you're not even putting fax numbers on your letterheads as much as what we used to. So communications keeps changing. But the amazing thing is that people think the most sophisticated communication system, which is in our own heads, that just happened by accident. All these other technologies were designed by scientists who spent years designing it. But all the human sight, sound, communication systems, total accident, just evolved out of the slime and the goo because of some big bang somewhere. And that's meant to make sense. Comments? Questions?
Yeah, when you talk about dolphins, the Zulu name being something about saving...
Yeah, the friend of people.
Yeah, it reminded me of a story. One of these grueling around the world sailing races, I think it was in the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm sure it was a very elite group of, you know, hardcore ex-sailors. And one guy, he wrote a book, I think his name is this French guy, Bertrand or Bernard Mortizier or something like that. And he was actually leading, so they left Europe, probably from England, sailed south around South Africa, towards Australia and around Cape Horn, and then they would return to Europe. But he actually he was in the lead, he was actually set to win, and he couldn't face returning back to civilization, so instead of going back, he came around the Cape again. And he went, and then when he was south of Australia and New Zealand, you know, having passed through an extremely stormy ocean, you know, between Africa and Australia and the Southern Ocean, he was exhausted and he was sleeping, and he woke up. He saw dolphins going along the side of his yacht, and kept on circling on the right hand side of the boat, and going like that, pointing that way. And he wondered, and he was wondering what was going on. And then he suddenly had a look at his compass and he did some navigation. He realized that he was doing his sleep. His boat had shifted, sailing north towards some very nasty reefs, and the dolphin was telling him to turn.
Yeah. Wow. Not just intelligent, but they actually care for other species.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. Yeah. I remember diving off, visiting Durban and diving off a yacht and swimming around and dolphins coming up to me and just, who are you and checking out and making the click sounds and going around and just like they're curious, they're interested, amazing. And can you imagine if you're drowning and along comes a dolphin? Absolutely amazing. It's like God has sent them along as angels to help people. Any other comments? Yes?
I just thought, I'm curious about the space shuttle, but it had 22 flaps on its, or like pads on its wings. What would be the significance of that?
I don't know if the number's so significant, but it's the structure and design of them with the Warren Girder and these internal triangulated struts throughout, so that it could be very strong and yet quite light. That's the significance. I don't know if the number was significant. Obviously, they would have calculated to be able to handle the stresses of re-entry into the Earth is very important. There's the dimensions given. Now, going to the Ark Encounter in Kentucky in the States, but the answer in Genesis Ark Encounter says the specifications given for the ark, those dimensions, are absolutely extraordinary because over the years of shipbuilding, it has been discovered that's the perfect dimensions for seaworthy vessels. If it's any shorter, if it's any different proportion, they're not as stable and so on. This is the perfect, most stable proportion. And now the best ocean liners and vessels are all designed on that same grid reference. And anyway, they come out to that tower. There was a time when, like the Spanish galleys, they were a lot shorter, more compact, and stumpier and higher. But the dimensions between length and breadth and depth and height, all of that God gave for the building of the ark in Genesis 6, is the exact specs that seaworthy vessels design now works on, that exact proportion. Yes.
Our design, the mechatronics, they have a computer and you're interested to know if it's like a machine that's actually doing something. Like you think of some kinematic cylinders going up and down here and there, and a machine that's actually working. just thinking of your body, like the way, how much muscle do you have? You have hundreds of muscles. Your face, there's about 50 muscles. I think just controlling your facial expressions. And just taking all the inputs and outputs that I have to get from the brain just to control my hand or my face. It's actually amazing. And I was just like yesterday, I was thinking we have to design a little system that grabs it off and places it on a place on the table. I was just thinking like your hand, how powerful your hand is and how strong your grip can be in comparison to this little thing that I have to design is taking so much time.
Well, yes, so just to design something that can be both able to pick up an egg without crushing it, and able to pick up an iron bar without dropping it, that you can adjust from the amount of pressure you're putting, depending on the weight or the fragility of it. You don't grip a glass the same strength that you would a hammer, and things like this. But that we don't even think about it. We're just adjusting like that quite happily. Or the way you might be running or jogging cross-country, and that terrain's uneven. And it's not like stairs where the stairs are all exactly even. And they found, for example, American soldiers going who trained and trained and trained in America. And they went to the Middle East and they found themselves falling and whacking their knees and shins because there's no regular steps in the Middle East. They don't build the steps on a certain grid. It's whatever's convenient. And so you can get it's incredibly uneven. I mean, that's typical throughout the Middle East and Asia and Africa. And that they didn't train them on irregular. Everything they were used to was regular. They had to now change the training. But the fact that you can be running on completely irregular territory, and if you're used to it, you don't even think about the adjustments you've got to do for going from grass to rock to shallow to soft to hard to this depth, that height, and going down. And we do this. We don't even think. But yes, if you've got to design a machine to do that. But the versatility of the human mind, eye, hand, feet, absolutely extraordinary. One of the first times I thought about this was my first motorbike accident. I came off my motorbike at about 80 kilometers an hour, Kempton Park, and my bike was rolling, flipping, and in pieces. I mean, at the end of it, the bike came to a standstill, I stood up and walked away, and the bike was in the workshop for the next 6 months until I could afford to repair it. Which means that God designed the human body better than Honda made that motorbike. We both hit the tar at the same speed, and the Honda could not get up. It was kaput. It would not drive until it had a lot of repairs. And yet I could get up and had a few bruises and so on. But the fact that the human body could take the same impact and speed of hitting tar. And, well, I did have leather gloves and leather jacket and things like that and good boots on, which does make a big difference. And I remember seeing the scar on the side of my helmet. And so glad I bought an expensive helmet, because when I had to choose, some of you might have heard, when I first bought my first motorbike for R1,000, and then I was about to get a helmet, and I had the 10-rand helmet, and the most expensive R100. Now, remember. Motorbike, 250 XL was R1,000, 1981. He said, if you've got a 10-rand head, buy a 10-rand helmet. So, good point. You've got one, you can't need your head, you don't have a spare. So I bought the 100-rand helmet, which was the most expensive helmet you could get. And after my first accident, I was so glad I hadn't skimped on the helmet. Because this is a full-face, tough, strong helmet. And, okay, the helmet was deeply scarred from hitting the top, but my head was not, which is what helmets are designed for. But just think of the difference between the human body can hit the ground and a metal motorbike is kaput and the person can get up and walk away. That's intelligent design. And it's not to say intelligent design didn't go into the motorbike. We all know that. Of course, that was intelligent design. But how can anybody deny that the human body is not intelligently designed? If you think the human body is amazing, think of the cheetah and the eagle. I mean, wow. It's phenomenal engineering all around us. So I think we can get a few conversations going with some of our friends to think about intelligence that I am the creator. And these are just a few ideas. There's lots, and I'm sure in all your fields you can all think of other examples that just show the magnificence of the creator. When you think of, nobody doubts that design went into almost some of the most basic things out there. I mean, even the chopsticks you buy, that design went into that. But they want to deny that any design went into the eagles and the owls and the people and so on. Any other comments, observations, complaints? So we've got next week, next Thursday, 1 week from now, will be Ascension Day. We'll have an Ascension Day service in the evening here, and we will be dealing during the day. We've got an all-day conference, a Faith, Family, and the Future conference. We'll live stream it as well, and there will be a children's program as well that's focused on some of the most life-changing missionaries of all time, like Mary Slessor and Florence Nightingale, David Livingstone, and lots of interactive things. If you know anyone who will benefit from that, just help spread the word, and also it's on the web. It's also on Facebook, and whatever we can do to encourage folks to support this. Ascension Day used to be a public holiday in South Africa, and it's still a public holiday in 26 countries of the world. Countries that have Ascension Day as a public holiday include Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, still public holiday, Belgium, Netherlands, France, Iceland. I mean, there's a lot of countries in the world. Colombia, for goodness sakes, Venezuela. There's 26 countries in the world where Ascension Day is still a public holiday. It was a public holiday in South Africa right through 1994. And I must say, I did not appreciate how important it was until Nelson Mandela abolished it. And then I was asked by school to come and speak on the importance of Ascension Day, and I actually had to study it in the Bible because I didn't know what the importance of Ascension Day was. We'd just taken it for granted. And only when we lost it did we appreciate it. But since then, we've observed Ascension Day. So, it's all about authority, Great Commission, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. No wonder governments hate Ascension Day. Because the Lord is above all governments and kings. He's ascended, he's reigning, he's coming again to judge the living and dead. So it's got a super important message. Any other questions or comments, observations?
Do those European countries celebrate it as Ascension Day, or do they just...
It's called Ascension Day, and it's a public holiday. Yeah. So I was surprised that my Austrian sister-in-law, Debbie, said, oh, it's a public holiday in Austria. What? The court said, yes, no, they have church services, Ascension Day church services on Thursday. Well, we used to as well, actually. So it's just tragic that if you don't appreciate what you've got and you lose it, and then it's hard to get it back. But we can at least observe it, and as individuals and as families, but certainly in our mission, we take Ascension Day seriously. So it's a great occasion to celebrate Africa Christian Action's 30th anniversary. We've got a lot of guest speakers and wide variety of input, and we'll be covering a wide variety of issues. And Thursday night next week, particularly focusing on one of the greatest acts of resistance and rebellion you can possibly do, which is home educate. That's resistance to the New World Order of a higher order.